cognitive computing to reduce the workload that a given person has to look at. Three-dimensional imaging, being able to look into the ground, look into buildings. Modeling and prediction, cryptology, hypothesis testing. Basically, security comes from vast amounts of processing power and communication. And later on, we'll see that these are really two forms of the same thing. Right now, the world is undergoing a processing overload. What I have here is the results of a 2003 study at Berkeley, which really looked at the world in 2002. And I'm not sure there's, at least I have not been able to find more recent data. But the point is that there's a total of about, in 2002, about 18 million terabytes of data floating around. And this chart kind of shows what media it's distributed on, and the medium, television, telephone. And you can see this is old data because you can see where internet is compared to telephone. To give you an idea of how much processing power might be able to be required to handle 18 million terabytes of data, let me give you an example of an optical processing problem that we once faced. We were given the problem of given a quarter of a million bits of data, just a quarter of a million now. What you wanted to do was run a series of tests on this data. And the problem was given a machine that was constrained by 5 years and $10 million, how long would it take you to process this data? Well, it was given to a group that does custom special purpose digital machines. And their estimate was, based on technology that could be projected, that they could probably solve this problem in 50,000 years. We also had a chance to look at it with an optical processor, and it was possible to build an optoelectronic processor that could solve the problem in about 7 months. So, 2 points. One is there's a lot of processing to be done. Remember, we're talking only about a quarter of a million bits of data. And the second thing is that optics offers a tremendous amount of computational capability. Well, what is an optical computer or an optical processor? It's basically a machine that computes with light. There are a lot of successful optical processors out there. Unfortunately, they've all been classified. At least most of them have been classified. There's one or two that haven't been. They share some common properties, though, the successful ones. One is they're all analog. There was a major effort at Bell Labs in the late 70s, headed by Alan Wong, and a crew of about the most intelligent people I've ever met. A lot of them are out there and started companies since then. They tried very hard to develop an optical digital computer and were unable to do it. Later on, Peter Guilfoyle, with about $3 million of DARPA funding, managed to produce an optical digital computer that had about the processing power of a PDP-8. So I wouldn't call that a commercial success. But they are also very fast and massively parallel. It isn't uncommon to find a parallel of a million, and occasionally you'll find a parallelism of as high as a billion. And optics design drives the design of the entire processing system from the very beginning. I have never seen a successful optical processor where you took a major processing system and said, I'm going to take this little piece of the processing function out, and I'm going to replace it with an optical processor. Every time that's been done, I/O problems just totally cripple the optical processor and reduce its efficiency by about a factor of 20 or more. They offer a significant advantage over conventional processors for certain types of signals and certain types of data. They're great for signal processing, they're great for image processing, and they're great for analysis of huge databases. They are absolutely terrible for balancing your checkbook, so don't even think about it. Here's a couple of pictures of optical computers. The 12-inch by 12-inch box up here represents about a teraflop of compute power for the function that it actually performs. It's compared to a processor below, which is a tenth of a teraflop digital processor, which is just a large, massive room full of racks of hardware. The point here is that you can get supercomputing power in a small package, things that can go in a missile, a UAV, an onboard spacecraft, if the function that you want to compute happens to match the functions that optical processors do real well. And I should have stated that the functions that optical processors do really well are channelization and pattern matching. Here's another description of optical processing. For example, if you have a radar system, you digitize the output of the radar, and then you use a communications link to send the data over to a digital processor. You'll notice that in all four blocks here, power is consumed. In an optical system, again, you have the radar, you digitize the data, you now apply the data to a beam of light, and the actual processing is done by a passive element, a lens or an optical computational element. And this was a characteristic of optical processors. They only consume power when you go from electronics to optics, or when you go from optics back to electronics. In the intermediate areas, they basically do the computation for free. Below is a picture of an optical processor. You've got a laser at one end. You've got a modulator that adds the data to the light beam, and here's a place where power is consumed. You have the lenses that perform the computation. No power is consumed there, and you consume power again at the CCD device that converts the light back to an electronic form. This will be important later. But why should you care about optical processing? Well, you typically get about 50,000 times improvement compute capability for a unit of for an electronic unit of the same cost. You get the advantages of size, weight, and power, and depending on what you want to do, you can actually achieve very high accuracy. Optical processors, particularly the ones that we've used for three-dimensional imaging, have achieved 40-bit accuracy. This is a quote from Pat Gelsinger, the CTO of Intel, given his keynote address in February of 2004. And this is something that the current digital processors are going to have to face. The power density is increasing at a rate that implies tens of thousands of watts per square centimeter will be needed to scale the performance of the Pentium architecture over the next several years. That would produce more heat than the surface of the sun. Well, this is going to be really tough on your board, not to mention be tough on the chip and be really kind of tough on everything that's anywhere near this device. So power has become a major problem, and we'll be talking a lot about that as we go on. But why? After all of these years where optical processing has successfully solved a lot of problems, but it's not really entered the mainstream, why do I believe that it will enter the mainstream in the immediate future? Well, the telecommunications boom has produced an awful lot of technology. In the past, every time we wanted to use a piece of technology or build something, we had to build every device from the ground up. This telecom boom has just built a pile of optical stuff that we can now incorporate into our system. One of them has been the hyperfine technology that we use that allows for narrow channelization. But there's lasers, there's optical amplifiers, there's array waveguides. There's a tremendous rich area of technology that's been developed. The optical networks provide an optical input. We now may be able to build optical processors that no longer have to go from the electronic world to the optical world and then back to the electronic world. The computation may stay all in the optical realm, and I'll give you an example of that shortly. The need for supercomputing has outstripped Moore's law. There's a great need for supercomputing for such things as products. You'll find that potato chip manufacturers are now using supercomputers to model airflow over potato chips. Why? Because if they understand the airflow over potato chips, they can force more chips faster into bags and tubes, and the faster you can package these things, the more money you can make. They're used for weather prediction. They're used for counterterrorism prediction, and nuclear modeling has been a big application for supercomputing. And, of course, there's my favorite, cryptology and encryption technology. They can take about all of the compute power you can imagine. Some examples of optical computing. You may be more familiar with the technology than you think. If you look at a transparent optical communications network, it has a lot of optical computing components in it. For example, an array waveguide, which does the channelization, is an optical computer. The MEMS switches that route certain wavelengths around are optical computational elements. Later on, we'll be talking about an all-optical encryption engine. Cognitive computing is an excellent application for optical processing. It's based on matrix vector multiplies, which is really a form of pattern matching, which fits very well to the primitives that optical processors can perform. Our entire three-dimensional imaging, both for medical and for volumetric radar imaging, came out of the optical processing world. And of course, there's pre-processing of massive databases. One thing that's happened over the past few years is there's been a growing convergence of communications and computing. There's this phenomenon called grid computing, where supercomputers are spread all over the country, and they talk to each other over high-speed networks. And it's gotten to the point now where the network has become an indistinguishable part of the computing architecture, and in fact, has in some cases become the dominant part. It's actually more important than the compute nodes themselves. This architecture allows for special-purpose computers to be added as nodes that can greatly accelerate some tasks. And, of course, I'd like to think that some of these will be optical computers. This high data rate networks will allow exabytes of storage. It'll allow redundant storage. It'll be geographically diverse and, therefore, robust against disasters, natural or man-made. And network security will be built into the optical layer. At the physical layer, there'll be no clear text links allowed at all. So what do we see is how these networks are going to develop? We personally believe that optical networks in the future will mirror the development of RF networks, radio frequency networks, in the past. For example, and you can see a lot of these trends now starting to occur. You're going to see the on-off keying of current networks go away, and they'll be replaced by things like quadrature amplitude modulation, which will allow you to get 8 bits per symbol and basically increase the capacity of any given channel by about a factor of 8. You'll see orthogonal WDM, which is the optical analog of orthogonal frequency division multiplex that we've heard several people talk about today. Qualcomm was talking about that. This allows you to put 10 gigahertz bandwidth signals on 10 gigahertz sitters and not have them interfere with one another, and also to coherently combine them into wider bandwidth channels. What you'll see, we believe, is the power will drop to the quantum limit, which means the transmit power on an optical fiber for a given channel can drop by a factor of 1,000 to 10,000. But now when you're in this low noise realm, by the way, that'll allow you to avoid nonlinear effects, which will allow you to put your 16,000 or 32,000 channels comfortably on an optical fiber. Parametric, virtually noiseless amplifiers will start to appear and replace EDSAs and Raman amplifiers. Fiber capacity in C-band will go from about 1.6 terabits today to well in excess of 32 terabits per second just in C-band alone. You'll take these many, many wavelengths, and you'll be able to, instead of having the current packetized technology that you have today, you'll still have packets, but what you'll see is a network that's dominated by virtual fibers, wavelengths and groups of wavelengths that will be routed from point to point and create virtual fibers that will be created when they're needed and be dissolved when they're no longer needed. And you'll find error correction codes will be developed that will be optimized to correct errors across these various wavelengths. To reduce cost, when you have thousands of wavelengths, what you'll use is a single laser, which will lase in thousands of wavelengths in parallel. You'll separate these out with a high-resolution channelizer like a Hyperfine, and then you will modulate each one individually. Networks will evolve from a ring to a self-healing mesh. Okay. Now my favorite topic. One thing that will protect these networks will be all-optical encryption. And this is an example of an all-optical processor that takes an all-optical input, encrypts the signal, and results in an all-optical output. And the net effect of this is the device has a tremendous power efficiency. One of the features of this device is that the faster the signal, the wider bandwidth of the signal, the better the encryption. If you had 400 wavelengths active on a network, one device would encrypt all 400 of these in parallel. It's a form of analog encryption. All encryption is based on an unsolved mathematical problem, and the unsolved mathematical problem that this encryption system is based on is blind equalization. It provides between 10 and 100 petaflops of equivalent compute power in a day and age when the supercomputing people are trying like crazy to get a gigaflop. So you're talking about something that's 10,000 times faster than their goal, but what you're talking about is something that exists today. Last year I described how the device worked. This time I was hoping to show you a whole batch of view graphs of the actual hardware running and view graphs of the output of encrypted signals. Unfortunately, we're currently in a phase where we're negotiating with our government customers about the nature of the security, and we're also negotiating with commercial partners. And it isn't the time to, we don't know exactly what we'll be allowed to say, so in the interest of not stirring up any hornet's nests, we pulled a lot of view graphs out of this particular briefing. But this type of technology would allow for a shared infrastructure. You can now have the government and the commercial industry putting the highest level of secure data over the same network, and that's going to be a great cost reducer. There'll be no clear channels, and we'll use independent, very low data rate channels to distribute public key. In this particular technology, let's get a feeling for the compute power per watt. The C-band is 4 terahertz in bandwidth. This processor will encrypt anything you put into that 4 terahertz. And by the way, we have 3 of these units running right now and performing just as we expected. Let's assume 1 bit per hertz. Assume that you digitize this at a 10 terahertz rate, which is comfortably above Nyquist, which would be very typical, and that you implement a processor that has a 1,000 floating point operations per bit of encrypted data, which is a good rule of thumb. Probably a little bit on the conservative side. If you believe those numbers and put them all together, then this machine has a 10 petaflop processing power. The power consumption in the current units that we have right now is about 10 watts. And that 10 watts is used to drive a MIMS mirror device which sets the local key. Now, all we're doing is driving 128 MIMS devices. 10 watts is very high, so there was no attempt to lower this. This could probably be reduced to 10 milliwatts if you wanted to work at it, and we probably will do that in the future. But let's use the numbers of the for the units that are performing right now. By the way, I can't show you a picture of them. The units right now are a 3U size rack mount. So something's about 4 inches high if it's in a rack. If you take these numbers, the power efficiency is on the order of a petaflop per watt, which is a 1 followed by 15 zeros, or a million gigaflops per watt of consumed power, or it's considered a 1,000, do this in many ways. I like a mega gigaflop per watt. And I challenge you to find another computing modality that can give you this kind of compute power efficiency. Quantum computing may do it. And that's a very interesting area. Okay. Cognitive computing, where does this fit? Image interpretation would be a great application for this. Consider a case where you have 10,000 high-definition TVs in each major city. These are all linked to computers. You cannot afford for every city to have 10,000 people sitting there looking at these things all the time. So what you need is a cognitive computing engine that can look at these things all the time, for things like terrorist suspects and for suspicious activity. And when it does detect something of interest, then it flags an image interpreter to determine whether this is real or not. The other thing you can do is if you have an individual that you have many pictures of as he's moving, you can fuse those pictures together and form a 3D image of the person. And from that, you can make biometric measurements and confirm who they are, even if they're trying to disguise themselves. Another good application is data fusion. I'll give an example here. Let's say you have a database, and somewhere in that database it's noted that money moves from account A to account B. Also, known terrorist Mac Z travels from Iran to Canada. And one of your TV cameras happens to flag an image of a Mac somewhere in New York City. Well, the cognitive engine pulls these three facts together and says, aha, this is a possible threat, and at this point alerts an intelligent analyst who hopefully is bright enough to realize that they ought to really pay attention to this sort of thing. Okay. 3D imaging and cognitive computing. By the way, the basis of all of our 3D imaging has been the optical computing. which produces about a teraflop of compute power. The 3D image can be formed of every container entering the country and all luggage. We could use diverse sensor modalities like radar, acoustic, magnetic, x-rays. After Tom's talk, I think we'll add the terahertz radiation to this thing. The images could be interpreted, would have to be interpreted by cognitive engines. You can't have that many, you can't afford that many people to look at all of this data and try to select the things that look like they're high risk for human interpretation. And by the way, historically, almost all of the really successful optical processors have been performed this function. They performed data thinning. They looked at huge amounts of data and flagged areas of interest where a digital processor or a human being can intervene and look at what's going on. A volumetric radar. I have a hypothetical example here, but right now we have this technology running operationally, saving lives. But consider a flock of remote-controlled aircraft that survey an area. There's optical processors aboard these aircraft that form real-time three-dimensional images on board. Optical cognitive engines detect the areas of interest, things like buried explosive devices, arms hidden in buildings, weapons under trees. And then it links these things that it determines to be interesting to interpreters for verification. So another application is pre-processing of masses of data, hypothesis testing and optical quantum computing. We believe that this technology will allow effective attacks on hostile encryption systems. Once you can break into those, you can anticipate attacks, you can infiltrate the groups, and you can have a much better understanding of what your threats are. So in short, superiority in processing information does make it safer. And optical processing enables this superiority in many ways. And by the way, the optical encryption that we described is based on our hyperfine technology. And all of the new optical processors that we're developing are hyperfine-based. But it, hyperfine technology permits distributed backup centers that are robust against disasters. All optical switching, which is a technology that is really coming about, permits fail-safe. In other words, if any path fails, you can always reroute your data somewhere else and get to where you want to go. Encryption will secure the data, authenticate users, make cyber warfare attacks very difficult, and prevent unauthorized control of networks. By the way, in one of our acquisitions, we ended up with a batch of cyber warfare experts. These are very interesting characters. If they weren't working on working for us, I think they'd be in jail. they'd be caught hackers or something like that. But these guys are really good. And it allows redundant and distributed processing centers that can reorganize themselves in case of disaster, whether it's natural or man-made. So in future, optical computing and networks will converge. The networks will evolve to something that's far more transparent. Actually, they'll evolve to totally transparent networks. Optical channelizers, which are a form of optical computers, will be used for optical frequency division multiplex or optical wavelength division multiplex at 2.5 gigahertz or 10 gigahertz channel spacing. All optical switching will use these channelizers. It'll also use MEMS devices or liquid crystals or semiconductor switches. And all optical switching will provide bandwidth on demand by allocating as many wavelengths as a user needs along a virtual fiber connecting two users. And all optical channelizers will be used to monitor all of these wavelengths and guarantee that running at the appropriate power levels, prevent wavelength conflicts, and make sure that people aren't tapping the fiber. Thank you very much. It goes up and down a lot. My personal belief is that it has to be taken seriously. If you apply Shor's algorithm to the current public key algorithms that they have today, they fall apart. So you absolutely must take it seriously. It has to be studied enough to determine either it's nonsense or it's real, because if it is real, the existing public key algorithms, which are based on the hard problem of factoring large numbers, fall apart. Because you can factor in less than exponential time with short algorithm on a quantum computer.
It's a special purpose, massively parallel kind of device.
Exactly.
Yeah. Any questions here? And why don't you tell us something about your company? You've made all these acquisitions in the last year, and just how do they fit with all this technology that you've described? Most of the technologies you've described come from the original ESIC.
Exactly, although that may change.
If
you look at some of the future acquisitions, they may not. They may be more in line with the optics work. Well, there is. For example, we had one group that was, I considered, our only competition in the area of optical processing. They worked at Harris in Melbourne, Florida.
Yeah.
And we'd competed with them in the past, and we'd actually used them to build stuff for us in the past. Well, they're one of our acquisitions. We acquired them. But for the most part, we're trying to become a one-stop shop for government and defense work, and we're trying to acquire companies that A, are profitable, and that B, add capability to us, so we remain a one-stop shop. We're not there yet. There's things that we want to do that we are not able to do, and our customers want us to do, but we're trying to acquire those capabilities.
What are these capabilities that you've acquired already, rather than?
Well, for example, the Windermere acquisition was our largest. And they're very much like us, except that they have a tempest testing capability, they have a manufacturing capability, they have these cyber warfare fellows I was telling you about who would be in jail if they weren't working for us. And so they complement our entries into information technology, and they have a whole group that, for example, they manufacture the secure fax machine for Rico. So they give us a secure manufacturing capability.
Any questions?
Well, the other thing I just did want to mention is part of our strategy is because we acquire these companies, they're all profitable. So as we start getting more and more revenue, it allows them to spin off more money. It allows us to do more research in developing these optical components and start moving them to market.
Are there any progress in moving the optical technologies to market for commercial application?
Quite a bit. That's why I had to pull it back to slide out of this meeting.
Okay, so let's welcome Stephen Sprague, the President and CEO of Wave Systems, for our next panel.
Comes to me with their user ID and password.
the problem they have in life is that they can't seem to remember their user ID and password, and so they keep changing it. They know how to operate a TiVo. Can't remember their password. They can play music on their CD player, but they can't measure and remember their password. You really have to entertain yourself with what they choose as user IDs and passwords, because there's an instruction on the Horace Land page that says, choose something that's hard to remember. You know, look at this password. It's great. I mean, this. Don't you wish we all had logons that looked like this? I mean, these are ones you can't guess. And it goes on. I mean, they figured out how to operate the alarm clock, but they can't use their password. And I'll end with this one. My daughter came up to me the other day, my 7-year-old, and demonstrated how she could alter the ringtones on my cell phone without any instruction or any help at all. This was just took the cell phone and modified it. But they can't remember their user ID and password. So I just wanted to start with that. That really is the security challenge we have. We hate this. Nobody out here likes this. But the challenge is much broader than that. It's who are you? Are you the same person you were yesterday? Is that really the data you sent me? And we all got the email from eBay that looks like it came from eBay but didn't. So how do I prove that? I want to have access to that service. I don't want to log on. I just want to have access to the service. Has my PC been compromised? Do I even know if my PC's been compromised? I mean, basically, we wait along until at some point in time it stops working, and then we either take the hard disk out and put a new one in or send it off to get fixed by somebody. So there's a tremendous challenge. Fortunately, the industry has heard this message loud and clear and ever so slowly has begun to respond, but respond in substance. And there's been the formation of a standards group a number of years ago called the Trusted Computing Group, and finally we're in a position where it has substance. There are over 110 members in the group, and we're beginning to ship technology. So millions of units have deployed into the market and are providing the foundation for what will be ultimately the platform for general purpose security on every single PC built. So the question is, what is it? Well, it's a hardware chip. We don't make the hardware chip. We used to be in the hardware business. We're not anymore. There are half a dozen companies that manufacture the chips, Infineon, STMicro, Atmel, National Semiconductor used to, but they sold that group to Winbond. So there are a range of manufacturers who build these components, and they, in essence, are a vault on which I can hold and create keys. And it's a key store. It's very similar to, let's say, for example, a smart card or a SIM module on a cell phone. It's faster, bigger. It takes advantage of all the hard disk capacities. It can leverage the Pentium processor in the box. So it has a lot of capability. It provides basic cryptographic operations, but it's not an encryption device, in that it can do key management, it can sign things, it can keep track of keys. And so for the first time, I actually can authenticate myself to a service provider of some type. But trusted computing, as we talk about in the context of the PC, is just the entry point into the market. The goal here is really to address a very broad array of applications. So if you look at the membership are companies that are cell phone operating system companies, some of the network operators, most of the equipment routing companies, and network switches. And the goal is that all the different pieces of infrastructure need to know how to authenticate to each other and create secured relationships, because we're getting tired of using the fact that there's a wire running from this box to that box, and therefore it's secure because it's behind some firewall. Because the network's no longer that. You know, that was great until somebody came along and plugged Wi-Fi in. Now I can sit in the parking lot, and I'm outside the building, but I'm still on the same network. And so extending the standards to include a peripherals working group, which is very active, and I'll talk a little bit about, and we'll be joining the panel today by one of the members from Seagate, and they're doing this in trusted computing as part of your hard disk, which is a very cool technology. There's tremendous activity in the mobile area, and we'll also talk about that further. And we have a gentleman from VeriSign very active in the mobile working group as well, who's going to join us on the panel today. So where's the volume? The volume is just beginning. You can see in 2005, IDC thinks we'll ship about 60 million units this year in volume as an industry. My general sense is that the 2005 numbers are a little high, and the 2006 numbers are way low. What's driving this? What's driving this is that
Microsoft has decided to use this technology as part of some of their capabilities in the new operating system. And so for you to get the little sticker on the outside of your laptop that says designed for Windows Vista, you have to have one of these trusted platform module chips on the motherboard. And the beauty of that is it causes the PC manufacturers to take an inexpensive technology, this is adding a dollar or two in cost to the PC, and put it on every machine built. And it'll start on business platforms and migrate ultimately to all consumer platforms. So what we've done is we've focused on what are the applications and software that are necessary to take these building blocks of security and turn them into a platform that someone can really use. Because it's cool to have a little chip that can store keys, but that doesn't solve my network domain authentication problem. If I create keys and back up data or encrypt data on my hard disk and I lose my keys, some people might think that's an advantage. All the data goes away. Other people would like to recover that data. And so you need backup and recovery of keys. You need the ability to issue keys and integrate them in domain controllers. And so we've provided a basic suite of software that enables the management, the deployment, and the use of trusted computing on a standard consumer PC platform. And we'll work to extend that to make sure that our tools will also incorporate the third-party security services and other devices, things like peripherals and ultimately cellular or mobile devices as well. So this provides a tremendous ecosystem for a foundation for services on the network. And so as a company, what we've tried to do is, as this is an emerging market, is how do we participate in the earliest steps of deployment? So some of our customers are, we supply software, for example, to Intel, that they bundle on a CD disk with every motherboard. It's a great piece of business because we actually get paid by Intel for every copy of our software, not a huge amount, a little bit, whether the customer ever turns it on or is aware of it at all. And in an emerging market, the best revenue you can get is to actually get paid before somebody has any awareness that they bought the stuff. The challenge, of course, is to provide a platform that everyone can use and continue to enhance that functionality and your awareness of that functionality. Anyone in this room who's bought an IBM ThinkPad in the course of the last 18 to 24 months has a trusted platform module in the box. And now, we actually just released it on Monday, and we brought a bunch of copies with us. In your bag, you'll find our Embassy Trust Suite version 5.0 CD. If you plug it into that ThinkPad and you enable your trusted platform module chip, you can install that software and use it. Many of the newer Dell machines have trusted platform modules on it, some of the Gateway machines, many of the HP machines. So providing a basic suite of software that we can bundle with the platform and build, in essence, an install base. So our goal is to put our technology and our brand and our tools in as many of these machines that ship as possible, because we feel that the real opportunity is to take advantage of this technology for other services. So I'll show you a couple of slides here. This is a picture of Seagate's Drive Trust technology, which is their ability to integrate hardware security into a disk drive. And one of the very simple things that you can do is permanently connect your drive to your machine, which means if your drive ever becomes separated from your machine, then the data on that drive is basically useless. In addition, I can create a variety of partitions on my machine that are controlled by different providers, myself, my corporation. So, for example, if I send my machine down to be serviced by the IT guys, I might have a whole portion of my hard disk that if they reformat my drive, that whole section of the disk with my personal data on it won't get reformatted. So there's some very cool capabilities that come along with this to manage the device in the network or on my local machine that provides a basic capability for security. In addition, yesterday at CTIA, as opposed to CTIA, the Trusted Computing Group launched its list of use cases that were produced by the Mobile Working Group for applications and really the basis for the creating of the standards around the application of trusted computing in mobile devices. And so there's a tremendous opportunity to provide a platform for third-party services on a cell phone. The problem with a cell phone today is it's owned by a single network operator, and if I as a corporation want to send my email to it, it's very hard for me to interact with that device from a security perspective. I'm going to talk to my network operator. So I want to be able, as a corporation, to put keys on that device that are in control of the corporation to ensure that the email securely delivered to that device, or that device can authenticate into the email server. And so a collection of capabilities that anyone will be able to take advantage of within the phone infrastructure to build service networks on top of these devices. I think that it'll be very interesting to see how this plays with the extension of things like Wi-Fi capabilities inside cellular devices, where I can build subscriber networks both with and without the carrier. And I'm sure the carriers will have some interesting aspects of how they work to control these types of technologies. So what in the end really is this? Security is a cool thing, but this is the missing piece of convergence. And what do I mean by that? Today, you can't get, for example, HBO on your PC. Your PC is a great television set, but it's not a set-top box. It doesn't know you're a subscriber. So if you, a great example is go buy a Windows Media Center PC, take it home, plug it into your TV, get on the couch, get out your remote control, turn it on. You know what you have to do? You have to log into Napster. You have to log in. Now, of course, it's the same login account you set up on your laptop where it says, please use an obscure collection of user IDs and passwords. And you're here with your silly little remote control trying to log into it, and it says, you know, use the dash key. Well, you know, you have to push 19 buttons to get the dash key. So it's a real challenge. What you want it to do is to say, welcome to Napster. Thank you for subscribing. You want your machine to know where it is you belong, where you chose to establish your relationship. Have every different relationship have different identities, so that you can have different and separate identities in different places that you belong. So the goal is to make security automatic. If we could eliminate user ID and password completely, it would be a good thing. I authenticate to my PC. My PC authenticates all the different services that I belong to based on the relationship I choose to have and the policies of those different service providers. Whether it's subscriber-based, transaction-based, click-based, it really doesn't matter. There's a tremendous opportunity because so far at the conference we've talked about infinite bandwidth. We've talked about the availability of that bandwidth coming to the curb, and then it's going to light up my house, and so everybody's going to be able to put anything they want and feed it into my house. Now the question is, how do I establish a relationship with everyone out there so I can have the same kinds of business models that exist in content and telephony and communications and services without having to remember 400 different subscriber relationships that I have? Where do I manage it all? How do I keep it in control? And how ultimately does the network move to a really dumb network? Lots of intelligence on keeping the bits going, but where it's important that I have a relationship with whoever the service provider is. I don't care whether it's my church group, my company, or HBO, and the services I consume. So finally, a billion trusted devices will ship. It's a very cool thing. Having the PC industry adopt a common technology and put it on every box brings normalization to how we do authentication. So the network will move towards being a trusted network, and we think the world's about to change. And ultimately, we can get rid of our user IDs and passwords. Thank you. So we're going to bring our... George, ready? Your turn.
What is Seagate's goal for this technology?
Basically, we want to provide an opportunity for users to fairly transparent with unstructured data, very straightforward, try to provide a brand way for the users to protect their data at rest.
And what does this do for Seagate? Why are you doing it? Are you going to sell drives with this particular feature and advertise it, or how is it?
Sure. The drive we're talking about, named Momentus MDE for full disk encryption, our announcement in June was about a notebook drive, which is our introduction that Steve was referring to. It basically
when you have everybody standardizing on particular technology, then the adoption is a lot more significant. So we appreciate that and are participating in the trusted computing group to enable common practices with the trusted technology. And VeriSign, what?
Okay. So it helps our business and actually provides new opportunities. So it helps our business in three different business units. If you could have hampered the storage on motherboards, on platforms and a mobile platform. It helps our content business units with DRM licenses. It
Your
helps
content business unit.
So I don't know how many folks here know that VeriSign is in the mobile content business through the Jamba acquisition and license acquisition.
Right.
We actually do handle 400 million SMS messages per month. Today we're the largest 50,000 plus ringtone Mastertone provided in North America. So we want to move on to moving, providing full track NT3. Part of the problem is that the endpoint devices do not support strong enough DRM. And if PC clients and handsets have this basic ability of storage, your storage, it's a tremendous one. For the payments business unit, we want to, basically turn the platform into a payment gadget. You know, you put your eCash on your platform, have it sealed to a particular platform configuration, and then you can buy and sell using that platform. And thirdly, for the TPM. This TPM chip comes with, each TPM chip has two aspects. There's a unique public key pair that in essence identifies that chip, and it has a certificate that is used.
Stephen, how does this potentially, how can it restore the end-to-end principle on the Internet? We've had some anxieties expressed earlier that somehow this principle was breaking down as Cisco puts lots of security on all its routers all through the middle of the net, and
I've said this a few times. I think the fundamental problem is the concept of the LAN. I mean, the LAN is a broken concept. It worked great when we didn't connect it to anything. Get a file and print sharing inside of our company. We hook all the computers up. It was great. And then we hooked it to the Internet, and everybody could file and print share off of our network, and that wasn't good, so we had to go buy firewalls. And then the problem was the CEO was traveling, and he wanted to still be able to file and print, so we built VPNs to give them virtual wires that are connected out there. And at the end of the day, what we really wanted to do was authenticate that the person who has the device that's connecting to the application in the corporation, whatever that application server is, should check and see whether he's allowed. And so this provides a tremendous foundation for moving ultimately to application-based security. I think first we'll turn it on for domain control and turn it on for VPNs, because I can do that out of the box today. Anyone who has one of these machines, has a Windows network set up, can turn on hardware-based VPN and all the technology ships in the box. But ultimately, you want to move this towards a foundation for application security so that when I go to my ASP server for my customer relationship management database of all the sales information on my company and all my contacts, I'm logging in with user ID and password, which means a little bit of social engineering. I probably can steal the entire sales database from any major corporation by just calling up the IT department saying, gee, I lost my password. Right? And they'll give me the same one I was using yesterday. And the beauty of trusted computing is for the first time the IT department can reach out and do something it can't do today, which is give you access that you can't get to someone else.
So Stephen, just a bit ago, we heard from Cavium, which is developing special processors largely to sit at enterprise gateways and perform some of these functions. Is that solution a complementary or competitive solution, and how will it interplay with what you're doing? Is that still needed in a world where trusted computing is widespread?
So in the short term, I think it's useful. In the long term, hopefully it goes away. In the short term, it'd be very cool to, within my network infrastructure, do authentication of remote devices and, create virtual private network everywhere. I think that's great. The reality is, it's such an unmanageable concept. I mean, from my reaction, it's just, oh my God, I got another thing I got to keep track of who's allowed to do what with. At the end of the day, it's very simple. The accounting department only has maybe, you know, even a really big company, what, 40 or 50 people have access? Managing 40 or 50 people is easy. You know where they all are. You know if you fired one of them. You know if one of them died. You know, you can actually keep track of where all the people are and grant them or deny them access to the services they actually need. Now, take a big manufacturing plant. Not everybody in Ford needs to have access to the stamping machines, you know, automated control. But, you know, there's three guys who really do. And to the extent that you can use trusted computing to control at that level, then it becomes much simpler to manage this complexity that's out there as to who's allowed to do what, as opposed to at one central facility, all 10,000 people's records are checked every single time anybody shows up. That's just a tougher problem.
Hi, Bob French from Mixon Burn. One of the questions I have is, well, if the PC is handling the authentication for you, and all you have to do is authenticate the PC, what do you do about the circumstance when someone gains the control of the PC? How do you secure that situation?
So there's sort of a variety of ways to do it, and I think it's the same as true in a mobile platform. So first thing that happens is I can have a simple PIN number to authenticate to my PC. That's probably the most simplistic and model that everybody understands. Clearly, biometrics is a wonderful integration, and that work's already being done by a number of the PC manufacturers. So my fingerprint unlocks my eVault, which is cool because my fingerprint never leaves my PC. It's just on my PC. I could certainly have another token. You know, maybe my cell phone has to be in proximity of my PC, as an example. Hopefully, you'll notice that you lost your laptop.
By the way, encrypt your data.
Right.
And encrypt your hard drive.
Exactly.
So one of the value propositions of trusted computing is that it's not just about the TPM chip. What you're trying to do is actually create a trustworthy execution environment. So one of the things that hopefully the future Vista will do is it has this trusted boot or secure boot sequence, and all the code that gets loaded is actually recorded on the TPM. And any bit of Trojan horse or any bit of code that you're not supposed to have installed on your system will be detected. And if you put that in the context of an authentication handshake, you know, my laptop to my server, every time I plug in my machine onto my corporate network and press on, I haven't logged on yet, my server is going to literally interrogate my client and say, tell me what you have recorded on your TPM today. And then the server will know, okay, it's got the correct bootloader, it's got the correct BIOS version, it's got the correct Windows, it's got the correct Windows patch version, and it's got the correct Office suite, any other application. So that helps in the case where my laptop gets stolen and somebody pops a virus, or I'm downloading email attachments and some code, you know, runs unauthorized.
Afternoon, Manger. I have a question regarding, you know, more and more we're getting into these SANs and NASs, network access storage, and vice versa. Now, the problem there is that there are a lot of technologies that are feasible that we can use. 95% of the providers, and, you know, we have all our data, a lot of our stuff in these back-end storage areas, devices, and 95% of the providers are not using any of these techniques. Now, it's great. My PC is working. I know who has access in my particular company to what data. Now, the whole world has access to that storage network, you know, through some tricks. What do we do there?
Well, I think you have to start somewhere. And so as you implement the new technologies, there will be policies for the people that are controlling that data to migrate according to the priorities and programs that they've got implemented.
So I would say, you know, if I was a fan box maker, I don't know who is in this room, TPM is, you know, based on a PC platform, is a cheap solution. The TPM is not a high-speed encryption chip. It just stores stuff. But the moment you can, you know, let's say you take out your encryption key and then run it through a fast processor, you instantaneously get, you know, cheap key management for your box. I think Mark is being a bit humble, but Seagate has excellent technology for this to do disk-level encryption.
Right.
And, you know, it's another...
Right. So the challenge are, you know, what are the threats? I mean, the problem is that, so I can walk into that RAID disk array and steal a bunch of drives. Nobody will notice because they're replacing them with other drives. So now I have copies of the data. If I steal all five drives in a five disk, you know, disk array, if I did it over an organized period of time, I can go down to Office Max and buy replacement drives. So, you know, I have physical security. Then I have administration, where one of the first and easiest things any corporation could do is go buy a trusted platform module, enable laptops for their five administrators, and then put the policy in place that you can only log on to administer your network from these five computers, which means that I completely eliminate social hacking. I can't call somebody up and say, hey, I lost my password, because I physically have to gain control of one of those five machines in order to go fix the network. Like, I can go take it home. He can carry it around with him in his bag. He might notice if he loses it. And then, you know, the whole collection of user access, it really depends on what the goal of that specific storage system is. Do I need to know exactly who's accessing it? Do I need to know he's just in the sales department, but I don't care who he is? You know, the whole range, probably the greatest complexity here is really around policy. How does this technology apply? The beauty, of course, is that I can begin to think about how all my different devices are going to interoperate. And we had this conversation about Wi-Fi yesterday in roaming. This is the authentication technology for Wi-Fi. There is no other. I mean, there are lots of other little toys, but none of them will deploy a billion devices, guaranteed. User ID and password might. The user ID and password rot. Because every time I go to a different tower, I've got to type in my user ID and password again, or I'm storing it in clear text on my machine. So this is a SIM module for Wi-Fi. You take the network, let's roll it out, let's put Wi-Fi mesh networks to cover the entire country. What you just discovered is a GSM level quality of security just is getting built into and shipped so far this year in 30 million devices. So there are 30 million potential subscribers out there who have not been signed up for a service. That's the way to think of this. And so there's tremendous asset that's being rolled out by the PC guys at a rate, you know, next year it'll be over 100 million units. And the question is, does anybody out there have a service that they think they would like to establish a relationship with a more trusted or better quality, more efficient business platform for the commerce that they want to conduct with that user?
Any other questions?
Last question.
Symantec is a member of the TCP. So this technology is very relevant to Symantec because so far they've been addressing viruses only, but I can foresee the future where, you know, if I was Symantec, I would be looking into, remote, what is it, configuration management is probably one word that you could use, whereby, I could register as a non-enterprise home user, register to Symantec the configuration of my machine, and that would be defined as my pristine, you know, integrity status. And every day, instead of, in addition to checking viruses, I could ask Symantec to probe my stack and say, well, you know, your computer is safe today. Nothing's happened today. So it's a great business opportunity for Symantec.
Absolutely.
Norm Rogers, I have a key fob from the E-Trade brokerage company. It has a six-digit number that changes every minute. You add it to your password. How does that compare? Is that as good a system as a computing?
So on a security basis, I think you have an equal level of security. The question is, do you really need to carry an additional token? Now, perhaps you randomly walk up to other people's computers and log in, at which point a token like that is a really excellent way to do it because I carry my identity credential around with me. And every time I show up at a machine, I've got to type that number in because I have no relationship with that machine. If, on the other hand, you're typing that number into your ThinkPad, why not just have your ThinkPad remember, because it's got a security chip on it, that you have an account there? And so I can have the same quality of secure authentication. Instead of having a 2-ounce token that I carry in my pocket, I have a 6-pound token that I'm also carrying in my pocket. Now, the advantage is that you might end up with an AOL account, an E-Trade account, eBay account, Amazon account, a couple Wi-Fi accounts, a couple business accounts. Your pocket's getting a little full. Because the other solution would be some form of federated identity where I have to either have a dozen different tokens in my pocket, or I'm going to use my E-Trade validated identity to establish an AOL account, which I'm then going to breed to an eBay account. And now all of a sudden I have one personality, and everybody knows that I'm the same person. And so then you run into all the issues from a privacy perspective that get federated across that. You're much better off to have 1,000 different identities. And if you want to associate my E-Trade account and my eBay account, I can tell them, hey, here's my E-Trade ID. Here's my eBay ID. I'm the same person. You can establish those relationships and break those relationships. Harder to break them, but you can establish them if you choose. Thank you. Thank you.
Please welcome to the stage John Phelan, Manager of Research at Synoptics.
This is one of my favorite companies that I tell history of in the Silicon Eye. So if people want further information about the history and potential of Synaptics, a commercial celebrating this company in the Silicon Eye. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Well, thanks. First, I want to congratulate everybody for making it this far within such a tremendous three-day extravaganza. And I'm going to change gears a little bit. As it says up here, I'm the user researcher concept prototype manager at Synaptics, which basically means my job is to be both Santa Claus, the fairy godmother, and the Make-A-Wish Foundation all at the same time. People come with me to my team with ideas and notions about what they can do and with our technology and other people's technology to create compelling user experiences. And my job is to scratch my head and say, we can do that. 6 days, a week, a month, yeah, we can do that. And so that's the perspective I bring to this. In the past, Dave Gillespie's come to you from Synaptics and talked to you about the technology that we have at the core. I represent the user in our discussions. Because at the end of the day, at the end of all these pipes, as you know, Stephen's brought up with his daughters using his technology, we've heard people talk about remote controls, the geek chic of the iPod, at the end of the day, it's the people that drive the use of our technology and our information. So I don't have to walk up there. He's having my laptop where I have to go. I'm a former professor, and in order to make sure my students didn't fall asleep, I danced around in front of them a lot. So I'm going to move around quite a bit. So one of my core things I'm talking about today is the fact that every new product disrupts people's lives. We're very much used to talking about Clayton Christensen's version of disruptive technology, and that, you know, you have kind of what seems to be clunky at first eventually eclipses the market leader and creates a new market, and oh my goodness, they weren't here before. Now we have no customers. What happened? I'm going to look at it from the other perspective in terms of from the human-centered approach, how new products disrupt people's lives. And if you think about it, every new product that comes out on the market that demands a change in your behaviors and your habits and what you're used to and a learning curve associated with that. And so our job in trying to sell more of these products is to try to minimize that disruption. But the challenge is that most people don't think about it that way. I'll give you an example. AT&T, when they rolled out the M-Mode service, went to a Bay Area design firm and said, hey, we're not getting quite the adoption rate we thought we would. Can you guys give us a hand and try to figure out what's going on? Well, the firm looked at what the M-Mode enabled and played around with it a little bit and said, you know what, we have an idea. They took all the executives and said, go on a scavenger hunt in San Francisco using only your service. They went nuts. It was terrible. They had no idea how to use it. They couldn't find what they were looking for. It took 12 steps to figure out a street address. They had not anticipated how their technology, when they're trying to enable new user behaviors and a new experience on the mobile phone, actually caused disruption. made them want to reject it. I don't want this. I mean, you're making me pay money for this experience? No, thank you. And so this limits adoption, as you're well aware of. It also decreases customer loyalty. The more frustrations people have, the more dips in the learning curve as they adopt a product, the less likely it will be easier to take their business someplace else. And they're going to be part of that, the anti-viral marketing. See, viral marketing, people think of viruses being bad, but viral marketing is good. So anti-viral marketing is bad because it means people are going around telling bad things about yourself. Oh, I hate this. This is terrible. Here, try this out. This is terrible. You don't want that to happen. And so thinking about the user and how each new piece of technology disrupts their lives is important. And there's three ways that we've been kind of thinking about it, Synaptics, about to minimize that disruption. The first thing is design a product or new service that leverages how people already know how to use other things. Take what they know. Rather than teaching something new, take something they already understand. A couple of builds here. Okay. That there's the Logitech Harmony remote control. One of the hottest selling universal remotes out there because it's really easy to use. You plug it into the web, you download all the devices, you hit go, and bada bing, bada boom. We had one user who had, no lie, 14 remote controls. That's more than 14. 14 remote controls in his house. Bought one universal remote from Sony, programmed it and everything. His family came to visit. He left them 3 pages of instructions how to use it. Okay, if you want to watch the movie, hit this, hold your hand here, kick your leg over to the side, and hit play. He replaced it with the Harmony, no instructions. They figured out how to use it. It's that easy. But the Harmony requires recharging. Most people are used to putting batteries in the remote when they get the new device, open up the plastic wrap and put the batteries in, and maybe in 3 years, if you can find the remote. The Harmony requires constant recharging. Now, how do you help the users do that? Well, we already are trained to charge something every night. Our cell phone. So here, Logitech used the behavior we're already used to enable a disruption in people's lives. Okay, you get all this extra functionality with the Harmony, but you have to charge it all the time. Oh, but you're used to that. It's okay. It's like your cell phone. Oh, I can do that. I got to feed the dog, charge my cell phone, charge the Logitech. I can do that. The next one is teaching people how to use a new product or service through advertising or marketing. Apple does this incredibly. The early iPod commercial had people scrolling around on the disc. Everyone learned how to use the donut watching TV. They just launched the Mighty Mouse recently. This is from their webpage. All their collateral tells people how to use the device. So in a glance, you're like, oh, I just read the entire user manual in 30 seconds. Try to minimize the disruption of people's lives. And the last one is the hardest one to do. To offer such a compelling experience, it doesn't matter how long it takes to learn it. And that is Microsoft, the Xbox. On the screen there, you see Halo, the game that's responsible for Microsoft even being in the marketplace. Okay, you've already purchased your GameCube. You've already got your PlayStation 2. Now, Microsoft wants you to spend an extra $300 when it first came out. An extra $50 for this game. Why am I going to do that? Because it's Halo. And for their target market, it was an experience so compelling. They said, I don't care if I have to learn something new. I don't care if I have to buy new toys. I want that experience. So, Apple Smart, they figured out ways to do all three of these things with the iPod. And as a result, limited by creating a situation where you drive adoption through minimum buys and disruption, take what people already know how to do, you offer them a compelling user experience, and you teach them how to use it. Even with a device that's very hard to pull out of the marketplace. How do you pry people's iPods from the cold, dead fingers? And the reason is that current market wants 15,000 songs. 15 hours of playback, 875 hours of content. That took you 250 hours that you've invested, assuming that you didn't do anything illegal, to burn CDs to go on that iPod. When was the last time you invested 250 hours in anything? So as a result, the cost is put to something else, to a user infinite. I have to borrow from the whole MasterCard Visa thing. It's kind of fun. So what's happening right now, can you go back, actually? What's happening right now, then, is that people are moving from iPods. The only thing that can displace an iPod is another iPod. You find people that have 40-gigabyte iPods buying a Shuffle. Because it's cool to have 10,000 songs in my pocket, all every song I've ever heard in my entire life, but you know what? I don't like all those songs. So I'd rather have 500 of my favorite songs in my pocket. So you actually have people moving within the product line, but not transferring out because of the investment they have. This drives experience. One thing we also know is that the product form drives initial experience for people. Nowhere is that truer than the Motorola Razr. Who has a Razr here in this audience? David Kelly, design professor at Stanford University, teaches his students to design products to inspire product lust. I want that now. And that's what the Razr did for people. So the hottest selling phones on the market today. Still has the same Motorola interface. Still has some of those challenges, but the form drove the adoption. So initial kind of response is, ooh, I like this. Look what I've got. I got my, oh, this is really nice. Now, on the flip side, long-term, the interaction drives the experience. Who here has a TiVo? People love their TiVo. Changes the paradigm of how they actually watch TV. It's no longer TV, it's TiVo. They spent so much time designing that remote control. Most times, the remote control is something that they happen to slap together because they have to, because there's no buttons on the TV to use the device. TiVo spent several, I think, tens, thousands of man-hours designing the remote control to enable the experience that they're looking for. There's a wonderful article in the New York Times in February 2004 that describes all the things to consider. They didn't just design for themselves, because as an engineer, that's very easy to do. I represent the ideal user. I have a PhD. I will be able to use this. They actually went out to the field to talk to real people about what they expected this to do, especially since TiVo is enabling a new experience. If the remote control was bad, you wouldn't like your TiVo as much. And so, bring those things together, and if you're really trying to improve the user experience and minimize the disruption, next slide, please, you want to take advantage of both of these things at the same time, the form and the function. Because this drives adoption, this drives loyalty, this drives experience. And if we're going to take advantage of all the things we've heard about at this conference, at the end of the day, people have to have a device that takes advantage of it. Talk about having access to the security. And how do you type in your password and remote to Amazon.com with on your remote control? Oh, my goodness, I have to, okay, then do this and over. And where's the at sign? I don't know where the at sign is. There's no at sign on my numeric keypad. The device at the end that the user holds to create the experience, to control the experience, is important. It's driven by both the form and the function. But in the long term, it's the interface that matters the most. And when I talk about interface, I don't just mean the hardware. It's the hardware-software hybrid. You have to consider both these things. A lot of people out there are willing to sell you switches and chips and things of that sort to drive, enable different types of interfaces. But you can't consider one without the other. As much like TiVo, it's a combination of the software on board, the service you subscribe to, the remote, and the device underneath your TV set. It's a systems play. All those aspects of the system help drive the experience. You can't consider one without the other. And so that's where Synaptics comes in. Our job is to minimize the disruption to end users. We're the world leader in capacitive interface devices. And most of you who have laptops actually have Synaptics touchpads. And my biased opinion tells me that if you like your touchpad at least a little bit, it's ours. If you don't like it, it's probably someone else's. But we're also the largest supplier of hard drive-based MP3 player interfaces. We did the click wheel on the iPod. When I first started working on Synaptics, I'm like, yeah, we make that. You'll have your iPod? Yeah. I like my iPod. We are the ones that make it cool to use. Oh, really? Yeah. We're also moving to mobile marketplace. We're in ATMs. We're in all kinds of different places. Places where the human experience matters. Our core competencies, as you may have heard in the past, are we're really good at doing mixed signal ASIC design. Every one of our products includes an ASIC, some proprietary firmware with fantastic algorithms to actually understand how humans use technology, how we create a compelling user experience. Tremendous software support on the PC side and also on the mobile side. We've been a lot more experienced in helping people understand how to integrate devices from a driver standpoint on embedded processors. When you have the whole Windows OS to work with, drivers are easy. Move to embedded processors on a mobile phone or a PDE, drivers can be a little bit more difficult to work with. We're doing that. Effectively, we're in the mass customization business. We've shipped over approaching 200 million capacitive sensing modules. That's a lot. And it's not, they're not all the same. You can't call Synaptics and say, give me a donut. We We work with our customers to tailor each product to meet their needs for what they're trying to do. We're moving early and early in the development cycle so that it's not so much you call us at the end, oh yeah, we want a scroll strip, thank you very much. It's much more at the beginning to talk about what experience you're trying to create. How can we use the necessary technology to enable this? And if as we work with people, we help them evolve what their user experience is going to be. We also have the ability to kind of do a lot of usability testing. We have tremendous human factors and usability interface design support within the company. So we can help our customers drive product. Because honestly, at the end of the day, Apple's a wonderful example. Apple gets this part of their core. As we work with other customers, we try to help them get it as well. Because the more compelling user experience we enable, the more products our customers are going to sell. And the more units we'll sell as well. So it's a shared kind of reality. So here's an example of some of the things that we've done in the past. This is the Creative Zen Micro. This is one of the Apple competitors in the marketplace. It uses a horizontal and a bunch of capacitive buttons and then a vertical scroll strip. This is an example of the kind of things that we do. They wanted both light and input because if you have blue LEDs, everyone loves blue LEDs. So we're providing solutions like that. We worked a lot with Creative to make sure that the behavior of this made sense. Imagine the old days where you would use a button to navigate through MP3s. If you have 1,000 songs, that means you're hitting that button 1,000 times to find what you want. That's a maddening user experience. So through our technology, we've been able to tailor the human experience so that as you scroll through, it doesn't take forever to do that. You actually get to where you want faster. And it actually gives you better control of what your music experience is. Here's one we did for LG where we did a bunch of tricolor LEDs for the Korean market. It's actually under kind of a convoluted plastic surface. It's almost like a quilt. You try color LEDs because you can actually change the color wherever you want. Makes people very happy. Ooh, I'm in a blue period today. I feel like I'm in a purple period today. Very much trying to tailor and help LG achieve a different, differentiated user experience for their customers. This one's kind of one of the most fun ones. This is a Logitech mouse in which we replaced the wheel with a scroll strip that allows both horizontal and vertical. On a curved surface. Most sensing technologies out there, since it's a mechanical resistor, require a flat surface. They can't do curves. Curves are more organic. We aren't made of boxes. We're not made of Lego bricks. Humans demand curved, organic shapes. Synapsys is enabling that with our technology. This is one of the prototypes we worked on. This is the Nokia Lipstick phone. That's not your normal one. We actually replaced the their resistive ring. They came to us and said, you know, we like a mirrored surface. So we'll see. In order to get mirrored surface, you have to have some type of conductive material. We can't do that. Capacitive is, oh, wait. For the first time, like I said, I'm part Santa Claus, part fairy godmother. We can make that work. And so what you see here is a synaptic scroll wheel integrated into a mobile phone platform for a very distinctive industrial design. Part of the fun. Next one, please. This is one we did for Toshiba. Some of you may have seen the Libretto. It's a very small notebook computer with keys the size of probably large-sized Advil. They're very small keys. And it didn't have a space for a normal touchpad or interface device. So we actually integrated a small scroll wheel into the palm rest so that you can actually scroll through large documents on such a small screen. This is for Toshiba to help them understand how this might help their adoption of this product. How could this change the user experience for what they're trying to do? So, at the end of the day, we're trying to help both on the form and on the function side so that our customers create better experiences for their end users by understanding and empathizing with what the users are trying to do. And that's really it. Is there any questions?
Thank you, John. There's the Samsung AnyCall that's been released in the marketplace.
talked to agrees wholeheartedly. What I've been hearing, however, is that with the iPod, for example, that Apple has chosen not to use the Synaptic product in their future products. I know with some touchpads, they're going with a Cypress chip as opposed to using Synaptic technology. So my question is, are they going cheaper, or are your competitors catching up to you? What's happening there?
I'll put a bar of military phrase. That's a question that's above my pay grade. I will say this. The Apple trackpad is actually an Apple product, not a Cypress product. In the past, Apple made their touchpads. That's how Synaptic got in the business, actually. You may remember from past discussions and probably in Silicon Eye mentioned as well. Apple was making their own trackpads, and it was kind of concerning. This is taking a lot of time. And they came to us, and we've been providing them for years. And this is their latest cycle of trying it themselves. As you well know, Steve Jobs doesn't like to be sole source to anyone. This is part of their experimentation. And if you haven't done something for a while and you're trying something out, sometimes it's really hard out of the gate. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. I have my own opinions about what will happen, but I'll keep those to myself.
Why is that?
The military again.
Yeah.
Passive sensing is almost a black art at some level. Anytime you deal with human interaction, it's very difficult. And the amount of both IP and just general know-how that we've developed around this particular sensing method and interaction method, control method, there's other people moving into space. They don't have the history that we have. They don't have the experience that we have. And what they offer, they're trying to compete on price right now. But what they're finding is we're in the module business. In the past, we haven't sold people just chips. We've sold them complete modules because of the difficulties involved in creating capacitive interfaces. The other competitors we have right now are in the chip business. So it's a different economies of scale on that, different price points. But the customer has a lot more responsibilities on their end and has yield issues and other things to deal with. And so our competitors are actually finding ways to create modules in order to compete with us module to module because chip only is so hard in this space. So much know-how inherent to it. There's so much trial and error. Almost 200 million units. There's a lot of learning in that. And when you have a company that's used to selling chips, and now they have to customize what they're doing and actually deal with what the customer wants, help them customize it, that requires support that they're not used to providing.
So what are the prospects for duplicating your market share and notebook computers and teleputers, as I call them, the cell phone form factor devices. So I will,
as a concept prototyping guy, I always have toys in me. This is a touchpad for a teleputer. That's for a small form factor device that may or may not see the open market, but I know it's in limited release in at least one country. And so it's the smallest touchpad we've ever made. And when you start to get this small, then that's where we really start to shine because we understand the usability issues. That's where our human factors and usability understanding comes. Because if you're doing chip only, you can say, oh, yeah, we can put a chip on that, no problem. Yeah. But to build a product, enable experience, that's where we shine.
So you think you'll shine in movement to the cell phone?
I think so.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Please welcome to the stage Greg Papadopoulos, Executive Vice President and CTO of Sun Microsystems.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to. This is one of my favorite conferences during the year. And the talk here is not. There's no Sun sales pitch in it. It's really more of a continuing to the thought experiment as well as experimentation that we've been doing, certainly in some large-scale product form, but, what are one of the consequences of bandwidth? And, networking in general, and it's been a theme of many, many years, that, everything gets attached to the network, and when they decompose into their constituent components. But what sort of surprises me in a to get unhooked in our minds from computers. You have a display, there's some computer behind it. And there's just some very simple questions one can ask in this way. So how would you think about attaching a display to an IP network? You can ask that question. Right? There's another kind of whole set of things of, well, what kind of experiences could you render through that, which has some technical issues around bandwidth, but also sort of user experience things. And there's a whole other angle to come at it, which is really the sort of thin client or ultra-thin client view. Why do we carry our personal mainframes around with us? I mean, in some sense, all this discussion before about, you know, trusted computing inside my laptop, that's a really big sort of sea change, keep with me or something. I mean, it's in some sense, you know, should your money be in your mattress or should it be in the bank kind of question. So there are a whole lot of kind of cultural issues that get into it. But let's give you maybe even another interesting motivation for this, which are displays themselves are a huge business. And this is just, this is out of the August issue of IEEE Computer, but, you know, this is just the TFT LCD market, and it's twice as big as the DRAM market or, you know, as the sort of the foundry business. So, gee whiz, why is this not an independent market? It sort of is hidden, it's hidden behind things. So that's one way to look at it. I did want to, just for historical sake, there's a talk I gave 6 years ago, and I actually asked George, was it okay that I coined something Gilder's Law here, but it was, you know, this, and you did say yes at the time. I don't know if you remember that. but this idea that, in fact, you know, this is from 6 years ago, that sort of network bandwidth is going to grow at a much faster rate than we're seeing Moore's Law and process performance. So it opens up these gaps, and what are the consequences of the gaps? And I sort of posited that time without a lot of imagination, you know, we would be sort of having to scale up, basically, go to multi-processing, and end up with systems like these. You know, tens of thousands of CPUs and terabytes of RAM. And actually, this was undershot a bit. I mean, if you look at Google, we think, you know, several hundred thousand CPUs behind that. And so there's this other sort of very large, interesting, the service on the other side of the network occurring. This is a slide from one of Larry Smarr's talks. Which now updated, so it's a recent slide, actually proves this out even, that the rise in bandwidth, I mean, it basically, I think Gilder's Law and the way it was phrased is actually even understating it, that the rate of growth in bandwidth on wider, this is a natural lambda rail, you see it growing at a rate that's even steeper than the multiprocessors that have been put together in the supercomputing side. So this is sort of, you know, normalized back to a Cray 1 and a T1, or a Cray 2, I guess, and a T1, and then sort of go forward to, you know, the biggest ASCII machines and look at, you know, putting, this is what, 32 lambdas down on the national lambda rail and look at the exponential divergence even there. Okay, so, you know, the thing that I've learned, and back to some of the earlier questions, you know, one of the fundamentals of Sun is you never bet against bandwidth. And so the rest of this is about that. Let's think about this consequence of bandwidth. And let me look at sort of last mile bandwidth. This is my own kind of trying to put together the best data I have. And I've looked at it in this sort of three ways of, you know, we were modulating over POTS, basically, using the 64K bit TCM that was there building modems. That sort of, you know, got us up on one set of curves. Then going and doing the kind of modems and encoding over, you know, basically that the copper would have to offer. You know, we got on another set of curves, and now I think as a lot of discussion in this year's conference about fiber to the home and the curve and all that puts us on another stretch. But, you know, if you look at this diagram, put yourself back to where the web really was, in the success of the web, to sort of built on the backbone of 14.4 to 56 kilobit modems. And I don't know how many people have 1.5 megabit DSL or equivalent at home now, but it's feeling kind of slow, right? I hear those ads for the 4 megabit stuff, and then my friends at Verizon keep teasing me about their 100 megabit services coming out, and SEC doing in the 20s. So we're really on this big, interesting curve. And you always have this question about, well, what do you do with that? What do you do with that bandwidth? And things do fundamentally over IP networks do get enabled by that excess bandwidth and our history of voice over IP, right? That, there was the 64 kbit TCM back in the, I think it was the, actually invented in the late 60s, right? And then how those have progressed with better codecs, and you see sort of the void standards in here at around 8 kilobits, in that range. What's interesting of what's enabled that better and better coding has been you can apply more MIPS at the signal processing problem to do it, but it enables voice over IP, right? It's some fraction of this network, and so we're going to put this coded signal over that network. Just as a bit of speculation, you can ask what's next in voice over IP. And if I'm a betting person on this, my prediction is, in fact, that there's more bandwidth to waste, and that the differentiation in voice over IP will be a flight to quality. That if you've ever had a teleconference in high fidelity stereo, you will never go back, because it is truly an experience that's much better on your brain. And it's much easier. You can actually survive teleconferences in stereo. And so I just think that we're going to start to use this bandwidth, and we'll see very high bit rates. I think one of the paradoxes for me, I bet, in 3G wireless will be people will be doing VoIP on the data channel because they get a higher quality phone call than they do it over the voice channel because it's been over compressed. Okay. So that was good. I think where this is going. If you look at it against displays and display technology, and here, just to try to get this to be bit rate on the same graph, I said, well, let's just call it 30 frames per second, 24-bit color, right? Kind of talk about the display itself from a human point of view. These introduction dates are kind of approximate, so the other dates are fairly well researched, but these are a little bit harder to really say when things go into adoption. But it's a much flatter curve, okay? But it's still high, right? I mean, we're, in some sense, putting even, VGA or something, XGA over, that's 1280 by, right, something. But these are maybe megapixel up to even 4K, which is going to be the new digital cinema standard. We still don't really have enough bandwidth in the last mile to do that. But of course, we all know the power of signal processing. So you apply MIPS at the problem, clearly. And there's been obviously decades of work in video codecs. I was a co-founder of PictureTel, and actually was the architect of the signal processors there and of the system. From the hardware side, and we were doing what was the precursor to HT61, and it took big boxes and things to go do, and now you do that on a corner of a chip. There's also, which is probably less well known, but and maybe people don't really think about it this way, there are ways of rendering two-dimensional desktops. By 2D desktops, I mean your normal Windows experience and Mac experience, not perhaps something that's you might be if you're a airplane designer or something. But there are lots of different ways of doing that, from the open source stuff around VNC to remote desktop protocol from Microsoft and what Citrix has done in a couple of ways. We've been doing with Sunray and in our recent acquisition of Tarantella in just being able to take essentially, a machine that's remote and get the desktop experience through the network. I hope that people are at least familiar with one of these things on here and have tried doing that. What's interesting is that the coding rates on here range from pretty poor experiences on these. If you've ever used a into this. And so, right, what's the next step? Is you just, one interjection about applying processing power. This is from Touch Systems, Jeff. You know, what they did, if you sort of say, you know, let me fix the quality and go up on this chart to high signal to noise ratio. So that if you can't read it, it tops out at 38 dB. Right-hand chart is essentially, the right-hand line is what MPEG-2 does. It basically says, you know, to get 37 dB or around there, you needed 3 megabits to do it. But if you do better processing and go to MPEG-4, which is ABC, H.264, whatever, all this mumbo stuff, but, just doing better coding, I can get the same signal-to-noise ratio at half the bit rate, so at 1.5 megabits. There's certainly a relationship there. So overlay these things, right, and you find this band sort of in the middle of there that basically handles video and these TV desktop experiences. And so, how do you want to think about it? Well, there's display over IP, there's, you know, voice over IP, there's display over IP. Now, unfortunately, you know, you say VoIP, and then this is DOIP, which sounds really dorky. So, I don't know exactly, you know, it's maybe do IP, right? That's a good thing. We kind of, you know, and it sometimes I'm saying something is really obvious. So you take a step back and say, what is Greg ranting about now? But what we haven't done, VoIP we seem to sort of talk about the voice experience and, you know, and if you put things with step and put it all together as sort of this independent network kind of thing, and I could go build a bunch of devices that render it. We still haven't kind of broken out of our thinking to think, oh, I'm putting MPEG 4 screens down on, you know, this new 20 or 100 megabit endpoint to my home, and we think of that as video to a set-top box or to some decoder. We're not letting ourselves think about it as a first-class network citizen. The way that you want to think about displays and that I can get to a desktop that's remote or a remote experience like that, it's like you have your channel selector and you can select any of these, you know, broadcast streams that are coming back down or do, you know, TiVo in the network. But you could also turn it to, you know, the station, if you will, that is, you know, your desktop and go interact with that. Right? So those are, I want to really think about this as first-class network citizens. So how do you think of a network display? Well, at a very simple level, it's a display. It has a frame buffer in it. You've got some network connection, whether it's wireless or wired to IP network. And you have an assortment of codecs. So you think of the display being able to decode, you know, MPEG or any of those standards there, but could also render remote desktops through a variety of codecs as well. And so there's some probably act as a bridge just conveniently to USB, UWB, or some sort of peripheral from that. I do believe there should be identity mechanisms in there. I don't think that the device I interact with should be my. I shouldn't own that device, but I should authenticate myself to that device conveniently. It's my belief and federate that authentication. But it's a very simple idea, right? You turn around the display and you see the RJ45, or you see the Wi-Fi compatibility of it. Does that seem okay to you all? I mean, it's pretty obvious. You know, what we've been, maybe it's the windmill we've been tilting at for many years, but this idea of an ultra-thin client with Sunray is exactly this. It's just a network-attached frame buffer, right? We have a USB hub in it. We just basically tunnel USB back. It's smart card enabled, and if your eyes are good enough, you can see a little smart card sitting out the side of this version of it, this display. And there's global session mobility. How this really works, all right, if you're confused up to this point, I hope that this makes it very clear. Your session is actually running time-shared on a bunch of servers, right? And the server thinks it has a graphics card hooked right up to it. But every time it goes in and writes into the Windows system, rather than writing into a local graphics frame buffer, that frame buffer is being encoded, sent over the internet and being rendered on the device. Right? That's a essentially how all of these things work in one way or another. The view that we've taken is a very server-oriented view, right? So that is back to time sharing. And literally, we run our company on this. So we support about 30,000 virtual desktops. We have these systems around. And, you know, this is the idea of what I think is, you know, the trust problem has been solved a long time ago in smart cards in terms of being able to store things in tamper-resistant form. Secrets in tamper-resistant form. You know, this is my employee badge. I can walk up to any of these the Sunray terminals anywhere in the world, including my home, and put it in. I mean, it just brings up my session exactly where it was. It's that kind of thing. This has turned out to be we've had some very interesting adoptions of this in communities that you might think where security and sort of reliability of that experience are first order concerns. So it becomes sort of a standard in the intelligence communities in that this is once you take your card out of that display, the way we've done it, and we run encrypted sessions, the frame buffer is wiped, so there's no state left on the device whatsoever. The other thing that I think why this will be a superior experience for people is what you really have is your data now is up in the network. I mean, the key thing in this picture here is really also the storage, okay? So the data I'm working off of. So if I'm doing things like even video editing or something, that's sitting up on the server side. And if I want to do something like do some compositing or whatever it is, I can get, you know, thousands of CPUs from a grid to work on that data. There's no transferring that back and forth. And so we do all of our CAD this way, chip development, et cetera. The really fat claim I'll make is that these coders get so good when you start to feed them up, if the experience gets so good at somewhere around 5 megabits, it's really a pretty seamless experience, that browsing off of one of these ultra-thin clients of bandwidth that's any higher than that will be a lot. You'll get a better user experience off of a thin client than you will off of a PC that sits there with it making the network connections. And for a very simple reason, that if you notice a lot of times in your browser, you know, when you go to a site and you watch all the connection traffic below and all the DNS traffic going on, you aren't being bandwidth limited. You're latency limited. You're sort of limited to what's the turnaround time of connection opens and closes, how are you interacting with the DNS service, et cetera. Well, a server sitting in the network can have a much fatter pipe, can be closer in hop-wise to the backbone of the network, certainly be able to justify things like very large DNS caches, et cetera. I think that these will actually be superior experiences. And just in case you were wondering here, people may have noticed, you know, a little bit of something about this is exactly how I did this presentation. That is a server farm of we have about 1,000 CPUs in Reston, Virginia. That's where my desktop session is. That's running this conference. Right? And what I have here is in fact this is a network display. But it's not a laptop. It may look like a laptop. I'll show it to you. And it's actually, we bridged this over. I asked for a wired network here, and it, for a variety of reasons, it didn't work. So we bridged the network connection in here. I'm running off of the hotel wireless connection. I'm probably only getting a 100 kilobits at best of action. And as I'm moving around, this is our desktop. This is actually being rendered, so you get this. There is a session that's running in Reston, Virginia right now, and this is the result of the video output being coded over the internet and sending it my way. And this is actually the Java desktop system, so it's our open desktop. But I'll show you things. We have things like Windows servers there, and because we can take things like the Windows RDP protocol, there's an XP server sitting up in Reston 2, and I can, and it transcodes the Windows session, so the Windows machine thinks it has a local frame buffer hooked on it as well. into that. Okay, so but this is a you know, your sort of Microsoft experience being rendered on a server again in Virginia, right? It just to show to see what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to power this thing off. Sorry to the AV guys, I didn't warn them I was going to do it. Right, the machine is off and I'm powering it on. It really is just booting the display and then going and discovering the. You see it come up, so it's actually searching to find its target server. So it's programmed up to go seek out a server on the network that will supply it. It found it. That you can't see it, but that IP address is the server. It secured the session and brought it back up. I mean, that was basically a power off to see my session again point. So thank you. I hope that was for just the courage of doing it, maybe doing less on the content. I would love to interact on questions on this. So I just wanted to be kind of thought-provoking and kind of get people to think about one of the consequences of bandwidth here. Yes.
Greg, I'll just say as I walk back to Stephen Sprague, who has his hand up, that I'll just tell you that immediately after Stephen's session out in the hallway, first thing I asked Stephen was, the trusted computing platform sounds great, but how does it work with a remote terminal? I'm really interested in that. And I didn't know exactly what you were going to talk about, but it was highly appropriate.
This is the trust I bring with me. Federated identity on the
platform. I actually have a couple of questions with you.
Sure.
About trusting. So the first most interesting I noticed, he logged into Windows. Even though he has a smart card-based authentication from here to remote session, he actually typed his password in order to get into Windows as opposed to using authentication, because your network server should know what to do.
So it does.
I didn't do any network authentication.
I could show that to you, but then it goes so fast for people that they don't believe that it was Windows. Excellent. So we do federation across the identity space with our WaveSet product. So by one point of authentication does the introduction to the full federation.
I guess the question I have is, it strikes me that this isn't an either or. It's really something that I should have on, in essence, every machine I have. But there's a huge benefit to also processing power locally. So they range in a variety of different cases. One is if I want to run an application and my corporation won't allow me to run that application, I'm stuck. So it's not an open platform. It's a corporate-controlled platform. And so I had a very interesting experience out at a conference where somebody was talking about forensic network intelligence and determining what everybody would do with every computer on the network. And the reality is, we don't carry personal computers that are our corporate computers. We carry personal computers that we view as ours. Our corporation paid for them, but we do all our personal stuff on them as well. So how would you view, I mean, how many people in this audience have a computer paid for them by their company? And how many people in the audience only do company business on that computer and do not do any personal business at all? It's zero. So here's the problem. How do I trust my company with all that data? Because I might do things that are appropriate or inappropriate but this is the question, which is, so you're carrying with you a laptop terminal, and so how do you view, as a user of this, how do you view personal computing and your need for personal computing with that device and your company's rules, regulations, policies, et cetera?
Okay, with respect, you're stuck on personal computing and owning a computer, and that's your entitlement. It's about the equivalent in the network age of a personal computer is not some network computer that I carry around. It's not that I carry a display with me. So I can introduce myself to any display. I can go through an authentication in which I can bring up any of the sessions that I need in the moment that I need it. The network limit of the personal computer is your personal network, right? And it's not owned by any single company, and nor should you want to think of your data being there. I don't know about you all, but yes, I've got stuff that's at Sun and Sun's corporate network, but I've got personal email accounts at Yahoo. And you know, I may use my network connections at Sun to get to that storage. But and I have things at eBay and stuff, relationships at Amazon. I mean, but the view that we take is very much that the collection of things that I want to wrap my arms around are all the places that I've deposited state in the network. And the federation of identity through that shouldn't be because I have some computer that I carry around with me. It should be some, you know, somehow I authenticate myself and introduce and things like liberty, and why we've been so passionate about that is for people who want to participate in that that legal relationship, you know, when I introduce myself to one service that I can get an introduction on the service's behalf to another. So I think I want to think about the collection of my stuff in the network. How do I wrap my arms around it, secure it, employers come and go, all that kind of thing. And then, you know, how do I navigate it, how do you use it? I would tell you this, that using Sunrise as I have it at home, it's actually really a drug in a way. I mean, you get so, there's no booting, there's none of this stuff, and, you know, just coming home and being able to put my smart card in, and I'm exactly where I was for my corporate stuff, and, you know, I have my own personal connections and personal accounts, and that's how I would like to see that stuff factored around. I'll tell you a little, is there another question here? And I will, great.
Yeah, I'm just going to say we can take one more question, because
okay. We're
told you have a flight to catch.
Yeah.
So I'm going to repeat a question I asked Larry Ellison 7 years ago. This was great, and I believed in all of it when it was time sharing. It was great, and I believed in all of it when it was Rob Pike's workstations don't work speech. It was great when Larry pitched it as a network computer. It was great when Doug Michaels pitched it as Tarantella. It's great when Sun pitches it as the Sunray. And yet every time I believed in it and agreed with all your points, individually controlled computing won. And in fact, the personal computer won over the mainframe because it wasn't the mainframe, rather than because it was better. It was because you could just go and buy it and you didn't have to ask IT to buy it, which that's one of my conclusions. So why will it win this time when the basic philosophy underneath hasn't changed a great deal? Do you think this chart's the answer? I mean, I looked
yep.
at it.
Okay, thanks. Bandwidth. Thank you, George. You know, it's bandwidth. And ultimately, the experience is better. And I do think, you know, we've been kind of, the network computer, all that stuff was sort of misled as the replacement for PCs. I really believe this domain is one that's far more powerful. And all I need to tease you with is come back to that, even in very compute-intensive applications. I'm a CAD designer. I want to press the button and have, you know, be able to bring whatever amount of computing to bear on it. And I think the hardest things are anthropologic, social, all kinds of impediments to this. I would say the driving wedge is security, and if I've got, you know, 1 minute, I'll tell you a fun little story about it. It's, as I said, that in the intelligence communities, we've gotten a lot of adoption for some obvious reasons, but you know, that it is really secure, and you don't leave any state with it, and all that is a big one. And working with one of the three-letter agencies, you know, they were just gushing about how great this is, and, you know, they can go into insecure locations and bring up, you know, very sensitive information, and they can pull out their smart card, and they know all that disappears. So I said, well, give me an example of, you know, like, where are you going? And I'm thinking, you know, like Afghanistan and special ops and all these kind of things. So, oh, well, it's really important for us when we go to the White House, you know, because we don't trust those guys. We can pull out our card and just. Anyway, thank you very much.
We'll start our last panel before cocktails. Please welcome to the stage Nick Tredenick, editor, Gilded Technology Report.
Riley is the president of the Consumer Solutions. And I'm going to give them 5 minutes, or maybe six, to tell you a little bit about MicroVision, then we're going to sit down and discuss all the possibilities.
Sure. I think it's
the driveway. Right here. Here you go. So here's Rick.
Now, as I understand, the way this works is I push this button, it turns on a light back there, and that causes you to push the button.
This works.
In any case, yeah, I think you're going to be able to tell that we rehearsed this just numerous times. So very quickly, I promised Nick we just kind of set the stage, and I think a lot of that has been done. George, I think, is very much on to something very important with the teleputer concept. And so we've got an image up here, and I think in a statement, envisioning the future, a platform for growth. So one simple way to get started is, what am I looking at? Well, what you're looking at is a silicon micromirror. What you're looking at is a micro-miniature beam steering device. That's all very nice, but what it really is a way of enabling very high resolution, very wide field of view, even to the point of immersive visual experiences in all manner of computing devices, whether they're mobile, embedded, and this is really going to be a key enabler to pervasive computing, generally speaking. We all understand this intuitively because we all carry devices around with us that we wish had much more going on in the display department. So that being said, why do we press firmly, it says, so we're going to try this. There we go. So we have been referred to, this chip has been referred to as the ultimate display. George made a point last year that he thought the markets for this technology were limited only by the imagination. The IEEE spectrum has said MicroVision is one of 10 companies for the next 10 years. And very recently, Nick and George made the point in the technology report that we're going to beat the competition in every category. And I'm going to try to just set the stage for why that is. So let's first talk a little bit about what it is. As I said, it's a chip. It steers. It scans a beam of light at a very, very fast frequency. But what it is, more importantly, is it's something that enables micro-miniature displays as well as cameras. We'll put that aside for the moment. The way it works is we point a beam of light at it. The light comes itself from a very small LED or laser chip. We modulate the light, and then we scan it. So it's almost like a micro-miniature cathode ray tube without the electrons or the vacuums or the phosphors. The reason that ends up being better, and this is really the sort of beat the competition, no contest, is in displays, we want to deliver a combination of performance, which is resolution, contrast, image quality, power consumption, incredibly important in portable devices, as we know, package size as well, and price. And then another thing to know about this technology is that MicroVision has really stolen the march in terms of scanned beam imaging and secured a tremendous number of patents with respect to this. The way this integrates into one kind of system is we build the scanning mechanism into the brow of this device. We scan down onto a lens. That beam is effectively scanned onto the back of your eye, and you perceive an image at some distance in front of you, and in fact, that perceived distance is controllable by the user. But here's something that's pretty powerful about the economics of this, and that's powerful for us as investors and you as investors. Is this notion of a platform technology. We will take the same scan engine and have taken the same scan engine, and we will turn it into another product that will then be embedded into the dashboard of an automobile to enable the same experience and enable you to better visualize information in that environment. Without having to wear this. That's right. You sit in the driver's seat. You're looking through the windshield. The image actually does not appear at the windshield. It's using the windshield as an optic to project the image on the road. And we'll talk about more about that, I think, during the interactive session here. But I want to put this in perspective, why all this is really important. If you remember when we first went from desktop computing to laptop computing, the very first laptops were sort of orange and yellow plasma displays that needed to be plugged into the wall. And that wasn't really a very good fit in terms of price, performance, or package. It wasn't really going to enable the application. And the industry played around and tried LCD and then active matrix LCD. And why did it lock in on that as a standard? Well, simply because it met the current and future
needs for technology, and then 15 plus years later, you've got a $70 billion industry from virtually a standing start. LCDs were very nominal at the time. What we think a similar opportunity exists now, and it's very much because we're not trying to go from the desktop to the laptop anymore. We've done that. We're trying to go way beyond that. And the enabling technologies that are pushing this now are broadband wireless. We've just had a wonderful discussion about that. We're enabling all sorts of portable devices, the precursors to telepewters, smartphones, BlackBerries, et cetera, et cetera. But another key enabler is low-cost, high-density storage. That's what the iPod is, big, fat drive. And we're seeing the cost of storage come down dramatically. We're looking at the image quality and the graphics quality of the Nintendo DS and the Sony PSP. GPS navigation throws another twist into this, in that I'm delivering information into mobile platforms. So what happens is the same thing that happened when we went from desktop to laptop computing. New hardware and new applications and new environments for users set up new requirements for display technology. And the way you win, the way you beat the competition, the no contest, is really all about performance, price, power, package, and beating the competition on all of those fronts, overcoming the trade-off, and then meeting the future requirements. So I think we're going to spend some time talking about the number of devices that are enabled by these high-bandwidth wireless communications, high-bandwidth storage, et cetera, and the constraints that get created. Every single device pictured here is in some way display limited. And that's why we've been able to successfully attract the attention of some of the major companies in the world working in areas like the head-up display for the automobile. We recently announced that we're going to align with Bosch to take that technology to market. I'm working with Canon on viewfinders for cameras, General Dynamics in the military domain. But I think we want to spend some time talking about some of the things that we're doing with the automotive head-up display and the consumer electronics domain, and what is next beyond the automotive head-up display, leveraging the platform for this.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. So I've sort of found MicroVision about 5 years ago when I did an issue of Dynamic Silicon that covered MicroVision, and so I put it on my list, and it really hasn't done that much since then. And so why, you know, really, what happened? Why was I not right about that? And I think the problem was that I actually was right about it. It is a good company, and it is about to break out with an application. But when I first visited the company, I think it was in 2001, they were trying to break into the camera viewfinder business, and that looked great to me, because you could look inside a camera viewfinder and you could see at the same kind of resolution that the camera was going to take the picture in, what that picture would look like. And that just hasn't really come about. And I think that the part of the reason we're up here to talk about it is, what is going to be that next, how are you going to break into the market in a big way in the consumer market? And what are the good opportunities that are sitting in front of you?
Well, it's an interesting dilemma, because the things that are the easiest for us to build, the first kind of products that we were enabled, are in some respects the most complex to bring to market. I don't know if you're still in the same location there, but if you can bring, yeah, if you could, and just, we've got a few slides, and I might even ask you to jump around a little bit here, so I apologize for that in advance. But there was the next slide after that one with all the logos. It's going to show a product called the Nomad system, which you've seen out there. It's a wearable display system. And it's not a consumer electronics product, and it's a wearable computing system. And when I say the challenge is in bringing that to market, it has a lot to do with developing distribution channels and the fact that you deliver this not just as a piece of hardware. I think we need to go back one or two. Go back a couple more. One more. Yeah, okay. So what it is doing is it's solving a real problem, but you're up against the barriers of change management and something unfamiliar, bringing something unfamiliar to market, unlike something like a camera viewfinder. So the dilemma MicroVision has always had is that the things that we could develop soonest, we have to create channel strategies for and so on, whereas the OEM business where you're dealing with automakers and camera makers and things of that nature. The challenge in that is you have not only your own development timeline, but then that has to mesh with the development objectives of those customers.
In fact, it looks to me, I hope everybody's looked at all the demos out there, because I think they're just absolutely compelling. I don't know if you drive a car that's got a head-up display, but if you look at the quality of MicroVision's display, it's just in a different class. And so I expect that may be the first really high-volume application that takes off for MicroVision. But there again, you're in that 1 to 2 year design cycle and the conservative nature of the automotive industry and so on.
I just think you should talk power, power, power all day long. I mean, this is the key problem of every portable device is power. This is thousands of times a better display, 1,000 times cheaper or per watt, or per microwatt, nanowatt. I mean, it solves the power problem in displays.
Sure.
And the first companies that elegantly manage to adopt this technology are going to have vast benefits from it. They measured in longer battery life, better display experience. It's really an easy sale, as far as I can see.
It is from that perspective. You're right.
That's the perspective. That's what all the telepewter companies are worried about.
Sure. And in fact, what we're going to show you here in a moment is how power translates not only to simply less power requirement, less draw, but also package size.
Yep.
Our ability to miniaturize it. Yep. So, for example, in the automotive head-up display, we've got one of our competitor systems out there. BMW is using today an LCD-based projection system like most of us would use to give a PowerPoint presentation packaged in a dashboard. It's got these great fins on it to help it dissipate heat. Well, think about this. It's mounted inside the dashboard between the instrument cluster and the firewall. Not a lot of room in there. Not lots of opportunities for heat exchange. So one of the challenges with LCD displays generally is that not only are they intrinsically not power efficient, but they're incredibly inefficient because they take light and they spray it everywhere, and when the display is off, it's not really. The backlight is still on. It's still being illuminated. So one of the big considerations here is, that George is absolutely right, is that we can judiciously manage photons and the electrical signal required to create those photons in environments where I need a very, very bright display so that I can see it while I'm driving in the noonday sun. So that says, gosh, I need a lot of optical power, but I don't want to dissipate a lot of electrical energy as heat.
And it's programmable, so it's not a single display. It's a whole array of displays of the kind that you particularly want at a particular time. So not only do you get higher resolution, you also get a variety of different display experiences all available to your telepewter when you want it.
There are a couple different modes that we're going to use in it as well.
So you got the immersive mode, the 3D mode, the 2D mode, the various levels of resolution, see-through mode. I mean, it just completely changes the display business. And I fear that people get preoccupied with the sort of clunky look of the Nomad or the glasses or whatever kind of obstacle it is. But once you see that it'll be possible for some company like Apple to do an elegant rendition of this that everybody wants to wear, this thing is just just blow away all these other display technologies.
Well, it doesn't have to be worn either. I mean, one thing I'd like you to cover is the small projector.
Right.
And I'd also like to talk about multispectral imaging eventually.
Sure.
You know, because that's something just nobody else can do in the same way. But we have a question over here. So.
Absolutely. You've got it, and that's been actually happening in commercial aviation with the head-up displays based on the legacy technology that's used in the military. They're so bloody expensive that you don't even see them in business jets, let alone general aviation. You got it. This thing is actually getting, one of the things that's important about that tower and that package size is if I can get this small enough, I can mount it in your aircraft aftermarket. It doesn't have to be OEM'd in there,
you
right?
You can mount in a baseball cap that he wears.
Well, that's actually possible, too. In fact, we did a neat little app with that a couple years ago. But I want to stay on this point that Nick raised, and then can hold that thought. Because what's important to understand from an economic perspective is the fact that this product required a very small marginal development investment once we had developed the Nomad display. And especially relative to the size of the market. I mean, you're talking 2010, 4 million units annually, about $200, $250 OEM target price. It's a very large market, and that's only 4 million pieces is only 6% of automobile production. So we're going to show you a next step beyond this where we further leverage this same, again, what we got built in here is essentially a micro projector into what we call the Pico projector or a pocket projector, but my presentation folks are jumping ahead of us a little bit here. So go ahead, you had a question.
Yeah, Scott Lemon, I was kind of curious, when I looked at the Nomad, I was surprised that you seem to be focused on the display business, but the product that you're showing out there is actually tied to a proprietary WinCE device. And I'm kind of curious why you haven't allowed that device, the display technology, just to be leveraged by any integrator out there to tie to any system that will take those kind of resolution images.
You can. The ones that you happen to look at, the ND2500, it's got a Wi-Fi thin client. We've got one that has just a plug that can be connected to.
It's an off-the-shelf product?
Yeah, exactly. It's an ND2000, I think, is the base unit.
And if you look at these mobile solutions, it's a Bluetooth. Whatever's on the other end of that Bluetooth is going to feed content, and our display won't care.
And unless you think that we did nothing in the past 5 years, back to Nick's comment, we've really been prepared for these markets. One requires bandwidth, one requires data storage, one requires a proliferation of content, IP-based content. And over the period in preparation for that, we were building several hundred patents, literally handfuls of platforms and configurations. You can see the partners on the list. We need brand partners. We were qualifying manufacturers to enable the necessary scale, both domestic and overseas. So a lot of preparatory work has been done.
Well, the other thing that happens is that markets proceed by making mistakes first, getting in trouble, and then fixing those mistakes, right? I mean, they went ahead and built those laptops with those orange and those yellow plasma displays because they could before they say, oh, that's not going to get us where we need to go. Same thing's happening right here. BMW is using that liquid crystal display, and they're learning two things. They're running, gosh, drivers love this ability to have that image out there. It's much safer than having to look down at the center console. Pilots will love that capability. But they're also learning that, geez, the thing is 5 liters. It's dissipating heat all over hell and gone. You can't see it in the noonday sun. You can't see through it at midnight. So it's got all those limitations that set the stage for another technology to come in and solve all those problems, the power problem, and leapfrog it.
So it's better to...
Who invented this? The concept originally came from a guy named Tom Furness, who was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for a number of years, and then went and founded the Human Interface Technology Laboratory at the University of Washington. And he surmised that if you could somehow factor out a lot of the inefficiencies of displays, the electrons converting into phosphors, generating heat and persistence, backlights going through LCD valves, generating heat and latency and smearing, all that, and address the visual system more directly with an optical beam, that you could accomplish great things. It turns out that not only is that true, but as you said, there are power implications. There's also optical implications to this. We can dramatically simplify the optical system, and we're going to show you in a couple minutes how that translates into this immersive, wide field of view cinematic experience, which is sort of the holy grail for portable entertainment and gaming systems and things of that nature as well. But I know you wanted to talk a little bit about
I want to hear about the Pico projector.
Yeah, exactly.
I want one of those. I also want the goggles to display my desktop.
So what's interesting about the Pico projector, this is not a wearable device. A wearable device we sort of lay out as augmented systems, which is the Nomad, mobility systems that George referred to, and then these immersive kind of homebound living room gaming solution. But quite separate from these wearables is this projector, and I learned something recently. I've seen projectors getting smaller and smaller, and they started to talk in Asia about micro projectors and increasingly pico projectors, where you could get a whole projector into a couple of hands
what I've discovered in the last several months is that it's not that at all. It really is a response to the limitation of a 2-inch display on a cell phone, a cell phone PDA, handheld computer. And all the stories about enterprise, that's what's going to follow. The blockbuster application is your Bluetooth portable projector, personal projector for your your handheld device, essentially.
Well, I could just have a roll-up keyboard and a PDA.
No question.
And a Pico projector.
Yeah.
And exactly. It'd be like carrying two iPods and a
speech recognition.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the constraints to making the computer disappear are the input and the output, right? The display and the keyboard. So we're working real hard on one end of the system and Synaptics on the other end. And yes, we occasionally talk.
But this thing's literally the size of an iPod.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, these renderings don't have anything in there to show scale, but it's about the size of
a cell phone.
Small mobile phone. So the idea is this would flip in your pocket. And as you can see, what would prevent that from being done with an LCD technology? You could never get enough illumination in that package without generating heat. You couldn't get the package that small, it would burst into flame.
CICLP owns that market today. That's what these displays are.
Right.
So,
and they're dissipating a lot of heat, bouncing white light or red, green, blue sequentially off of those. And in many cases, to get the color quality, they need three chips and so on. This can be shrunk to a much smaller package size, both because of the optics and because of that.
And the optics are really important. So you look at every projector today and it has a large final optic and has optics within optics to make that happen. And it's because the image is coming from some sort of a plane, whether that be an LCD or a TIDLP. In our solution, there's no lens.
Right.
It's a 1-inch mirror, a 1-millimeter mirror, essentially. All the lenses go away. And that's really a big part of this compression.
You see our friend here taking pictures. That lens is very impressive. But that's a big piece of glass, and that's really what we're talking about. And the reason he's got that is because he's imaging onto a postage stamp size sensor or film, for that matter. You're really doing the same thing with a projection display. You're starting with a postage stamp size LCD or DLP, and then sticking magnifying optics in front of it to create this appearance of a much larger screen. And we don't start with a postage stamp size display. We start with a beam that is scanning outward, so it's got its own sort of magnification going to begin with. The head-up display design doesn't use any magnifying optics. It uses two curved mirrors. And we'll show you a system in a moment that sort of breaks the rules in terms of how you get to that cinematic experience in a wearable display. Now, it's interesting because someone said, I'm not sure I'd wear a display. I said, yes, but your 14-year-old and your 16-year-old in 2 or 3 years are going to be, I guarantee you, to the extent that these things are available in the market, putting them on to experience the experience of a 200-inch diagonal screen with resolution, contrast, and color saturation like you've never seen in 3D, so that they can watch movies and play video games.
And that's going to be $200 in 3 years?
Well, exactly. Let me show you. This gets kind of interesting because there's a reason. We'll just skip past this. Yeah, let's look at this. Here we are with the products that exist in the market today. You can go out there and you can get something that's going to give you this widescreen experience in a wearable display. That's if you've got anywhere between $30,000 and $90,000 hanging around, and you're willing to put on 2 to 6 pounds of apparatus. The reason for that is optics. And by the way, these don't look any different than the same devices that were available in the market 10 years ago. And the reason is what they're up against is not about the image source anymore. It's about what that implies relative to the optics. So the diagram is showing you that what we have to do to get that postage stamp display to look like that big screen is to bend the light out at a very wide angle. We need more than one lens to do that. That's why he's got that big apparatus there. And then because when we bend the light, we introduce color aberrations, red, green, and blue all bend at slightly different angles. We need another lens to correct for those. And before you know it, you got thousands of dollars worth of glass, which is very, very bulky. So the question is, how do you get around that? And one of our more brilliant scientists came up with this concept. And we have sort of alluded to this in the past, but this is the first time we've really described it to anyone. What we call a pupil-centered display. And the idea is that what you're trying to do here is get the light to come onto your eye from the same angles that a movie screen would give you, or a very, very large screen. And so instead of trying to bend the light outward from a plane, from a flat source, you bend the source. Well, if you do that, now all I need is a mirror that's bent at the same angle. And if the light's going out at that angle, it's going to come back in the eye. So what you're seeing is what we call a ray trace. There's one small problem with this. If we can see all those rays originating at what we call the curved virtual surface, but they have to pass back through that surface as well. So the word that ends up being very important there is virtual. You can't stick a physical screen there of any kind and curve it because the rays can't go back through it. So the only way you can accomplish this is with this apparatus, which takes an array of light-emitting diodes, positions it in front of the eye. This is all MEMS-based, the system, and moves those beams up and down and sends them out, creating this virtual curved plane. Those rays then go out to a curved mirror. And I think this is what George is after in terms of stylization. Here's your 200-inch diagonal screen at 10 feet, stereo 3D, more than HD resolution because, again, you're using arrays of light sources, and it's a couple of $100 and a few ounces instead of $90,000 and a few pounds.
And so we can't have this because there's the same problem with getting it to the market.
This one's a little different. Keep in mind, everything we've described up to now, the Nomad, the head-up display, the Pico projector, are all cases where the light source is stationary and we're scanning the mirror. In this case, we've turned it on its head, and we've got instead of having a small moving mirror, we've got a big stationary mirror and a small moving light source. This is a little bit of a step function in development for us.
Okay.
Having said that, it's also something that endows one of the three major game platform players, console makers, with an unassailable market advantage because you leave your competitors stuck with the $90,000 non-starter apparatus.
But you got to go train those guys and somehow...
Here's what trains them. The market trains them. And what one of the reasons we think that gaming is maybe the space to start adopting this is that the differentiators are starting to go out from under them, right? It used to be about who's got more polygons and so on. And then it was about, who's got the best title. That playing field's been pretty well leveled at this point. So they're really, and one thing that is really good about the gaming space in terms of the customer base is they really are attuned to the fact that at the end of the day what they're selling is an experience. And this concept of immersive is very much viewed as a holy grail by these folks. And I think they also have appreciated why historically it's been a little bit of unobtainium for them. So I think we are seeing some motivation as that space becomes more hotly contested to sort of move towards things that are really going to define the experience in radical new ways. Any questions?
Yeah, will you have the prototype here next year? Will that be one of the demos?
It's a work in process for us, and it's a question of how we accelerate that effort.
Yeah, I think, realistically, 2.5 years, maybe three. What will precede that is obviously, just as we've sort of announced our go-to-market arrangement with Bosch, and in fact, it's really the precursor of that arrangement with Bosch, we'll have go-to-market strategic partners with this. We've been very successful in doing something else that's pretty powerful economically, which is we come to the table and say, look, we're bringing all this technology to the table. You need to pay for the incremental cost to productize this, and in exchange for that, we'll give you some sort of first-mover advantage or some sort of market advantage.
One of the things we are doing to accelerate it is to work manufacturing processes in parallel. So as we make that shift from today's industrial medical defense work to consumer electronics, manufacturers and manufacturing processes are vital. So we are absolutely working design of those processes and design of the product
on parallel tracks, and that is going to accelerate this program.
Yeah, actually, we didn't talk about any of the medical imaging applications or the near-field camera or multispectral imaging or any of that, but I see, I mean, you guys just hired some medical whiz kid from GE or something. How does that fit into making this a multi-billion dollar company in 2 years?
Well, I think... careful how you answer that.
Yeah, Alec can be here.
A guy named Alec Tokman came to us from GE Healthcare Systems, and what we were really looking for is an operator, because when you're doing all these things, you're sort of managing this portfolio of commercialization initiatives, multiple partnerships, multiple technologies. To the extent that you can be really effective in every cycle, whether it's a sales cycle or a marketing cycle or any other kind of cycle, production cycle that drives business, that's where you get leverage out of the resources. So his background in medical imaging is clearly important because he's got tremendous technical expertise. But what we really felt we needed to do as we were now getting to the point, the sort of inflection point where we're seeing multiple products begin the cycle of entering the market, is it was really about achieving operational excellence to match the technical excellence that we've demonstrated in the past.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
thank you. The high point, the real summit of this conference every year for 9 years now is